You're listening to podcasts from the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee, www.netcaucus.org.
Okay, folks, welcome. We're going to go ahead and get started. My name is Eric Hinkes. I am the Legal Policy Fellow for the Congressional Internet Caucus Advisory Committee. I want to thank you so much for coming out today. Today's event is called, If Patent Litigation is Strangling High-Tech Innovation, When Will Congress Act? I first want to thank the Congressional Internet Caucus co-chairs, Senator Leahy, Senator Thune, Congressman Goodlatte, and Congresswoman Eshoo for helping us put this event together today. Their leadership to host these debates is really important, and we are really in their debt for their support. We also hope you can join us next week, June 7th, for our next event, Face Off, a fact-based debate on U.S. Internet policy and access networks. We'll discuss Internet economics and what role, if any, government regulations should play in overseeing these networks. Today's hashtag, as you know, is ICAC Patents. And so we'll just set the stage here. It seems as if the ink has barely dried on Congress's last patent reform law, doesn't it? I mean, the American Invents Act, years in the making, was enacted into law in September of 2011. Yet during an online chat this past February, President Obama said our efforts at patent reform only went halfway to the point where they need to go, and he called for smarter patent laws. It's also important to know that last year, the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office reported that IP-intensive industries supported at least 40 million jobs in the U.S., contributed more than $5 trillion to the economy, and accounted for nearly 35% of GDP. It's also interesting to note that the U.S. government recently announced a revision to how it's going to estimate GDP. Starting July 31st, the Bureau of Economic Analysis will record expenditures for R&D and for entertainment artistic works and group them with expenditures for software into a new investment category called intellectual property products. As GDP figures are routinely used to determine fundamental policy matters that affect everyday citizens' lives, with these revisions, the IP economy is likely to be even bigger than we think it is. In the midst of all this, Congress has been actively exploring additional fixes and tweaks to the patent system. The House IP Subcommittee held hearings in March and April of this year on the topic of abusive patent litigation. Just last week, Chairman Goodlatte released a discussion draft of legislation to address what he termed the ever-increasing problem of abusive patent litigation. Chairman Leahy said that he expects to introduce separate legislation soon as well. Other legislation in the House includes the SHIELD Act, introduced by Congressman DeFazio and Congressman Chaffetz, the Patent Quality Improvement Act in the Senate, introduced by Senator Schumer, and the Patent Abuse and Reduction Act, introduced by Senator Cornyn. There's even action at the state level. Vermont's Attorney General brought a suit against the Patent Assertion Entity, or PAE, under the state's Consumer Protection Act. So where does this all leave us? Well, it's a great time to talk about this important issue that affects major sectors of our economy and jobs. Our goal today is to provide a concise overview on why this issue should matter for you. So our panelists, I'll briefly introduce them. Scott Burt is Senior VP and Chief IP Officer with Mossade Technologies. Adam Mossoff is a Professor of Law at GMU School of Law. Matt Schurz is a VP of Law and Policy with CCIA. And Tim Sparapani is VP of Law Policy and Government Affairs with the Application Developers Alliance. So I want to thank each of them for appearing today, and I'll give them each an opportunity to give you a brief rundown from their unique vantage point. And we'll take questions at the end.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. First, I'm going to introduce my company briefly because most of you probably not heard of Mossade Technologies. We are an IP management company, which means that primarily what we do is we license patents. Some of those patents are patents that we have developed through our own research and development efforts over the last almost 40 years of the company. Some of those patents are patents we've acquired. And in addition to licensing patents, sometimes we sell patents. We license primarily in the semiconductor and telecom industries, and we have a portfolio right now between about 5,500, almost 6,000 patents, and we're located in Plano, Texas, in Ottawa. For me personally, I was with an international law firm for about 20 years before I joined Mossade last year, and for those 20-plus years, I did patent litigation, and I represented both plaintiffs and defendants in patent litigation. So I've pretty much seen it all. I've seen the developments of patent litigation in the United States and seen the good and the bad.
Thank you, Scott. And Scott's a hard act to follow. I'm the academic here to provide senseless and head in the clouds commentary on real-world concerns that actually are affecting everyone from Scott's company to those of you in the room. that perspective, I'd like to continue my role that I've adopted in many other briefings and talks, where I have been speaking largely against the conventional wisdom today that there is a problem. That the very title of our briefing, that, you know, if litigation is strangling high tech innovation, you know, when will Congress act? Well, I would like to challenge that very premise as to whether the patent system and patent litigation is in fact strangling high tech innovation. I find it very interesting that people are writing this commentary on their latest smartphone, Samsung, which just lost a massive case to Apple, just came out with the new Galaxy S4, where it has retinal scanning capabilities, and you don't even have to touch the screen anymore. You can just swipe your hands in the air. We're moving even closer to the air swiping that we may remember from Minority Report, which was just pure science fiction just 5 or 6 years ago. You know, we have our tablets, which are also just amazing technological innovation that comes out every couple months. In fact, I'm here also with my infringing Samsung tablet 10.1, which actually had a preliminary injunction against it. Yet I have it in the room. please don't report me. I very much feel like Cassandra at times, this is a high-tech panel, so that's a little too highfalutin reference. I very much feel like Ripley in Aliens, too, where she's constantly warning people that I'm kind of the reverse. I don't think there necessarily is a problem here. Historically, litigation rates are exactly the same that they have been since the early 19th century. Patent litigation rates in the 19th century averaged around 1.5%. Today, patent litigation rates are, wait for it, around 1.5%. And we have amazing technological innovation, both in the high-tech and biotech industries, strong patenting in those industries that is going along with that innovation. And my general position is I don't necessarily think that there's a problem here.
Matt. My name is Matt Shears. I'm with the Computer and Communications Industry Association, which is a trade association of internet and technology companies. Those companies are many of the businesses that are spending what recent research shows about $29 billion, and that's in 2011, up from $7 billion a year on patent litigation in 2005. A lot of that, a substantial part of that actually, is to what people call trolls, more sort of neutrally patent assertion entities whose product is only litigation. They exist for the purpose of suing, and they are a substantial drag on the economy because resources being invested that would have been invested in R&D, which will ultimately be counted in the numbers that Eric was referring to earlier, are instead being devoted towards expenses on research on litigation instead of research, and that's having a substantial negative effect on our ability to field new products. And so it's true that we have lots of great new technology, but we can't say that because we have technology, that means the patent system's working. That's kind of like me telling you that because I'm wearing tiger repellent, there's no tigers around here, right? And there's obviously other reasons why there's no tigers here. Correlation isn't causation. And so the contention that I would leave you with is that if we didn't have U.S. industry spending $29 billion on patent lawyers, they'd be spending it on something more interesting like R&D and engineers to produce more products like the ones Adam's just showing.
So thank you to the Congressional Internet Caucus. My name is Tim Sparapani. I'm with the Application Developers Alliance, and for sake of everyone's edification, we're a relatively new organization, about 17 months young. We have 25,000-plus developers who have joined the Alliance in just those 17 months. This is the fastest-growing industry in America. I think it's the most dynamic and exciting. I'm happy to help represent it. And our members are the front line of the scourge of patent troll activity that's happening out there. And I can tell you that from big and small and in between, our members are feeling not only threatened, but in many ways crushed by the demand letters they're receiving from entities which are alleging that they are infringing on patents, in many cases erroneously. So, quick overview, we are running a nationwide patent summit series set of conversations. We've already been in 6 cities around the country convening developers who are the people who are building America's great businesses, building all the apps that you're used to seeing and the ones you're going to see in the future. And what they're telling us is that this is their experience. They are really feeling the pressure of getting these demand letters. So their experience is, I think, the leading edge of this fight that's happening. And Professor, what they're experiencing and what they're telling us is that they don't even get to the litigation moment. So the litigation figures that you've cited, I don't think are reflective of the actual experience of this small app developer. If you've got 8, maybe 10 employees, if you just raised a couple $1 million and you're really lucky because you've got a great technology and you see a business that you can launch, and then you get a demand letter, you don't turn around and say, we're going to go ahead and litigate, we're going to spend that $2 million hiring patent attorneys and going through a multi-year fight because you're trying to birth your business. Instead, what you say is, I have a terrible choice to make. Do I immediately pick up the phone and pay this licensing fee to use a technology which everyone thought was foundational at the cost of $30,000, $50,000, maybe $100,000 and make this problem go away so they can get on with building a business? So what we're seeing at the Application Developers Alliance is a pre-litigation problem, and it's an extortionate problem, and we are urging Congress to act as soon as possible. We're heartened by the introduction of multiple pieces of legislation in recent times to get the discussion rolling.
Okay, thank you very much. So I think one interesting part to start with is much of the proposed legislation, including Chairman Goodlatte's recent discussion draft, focuses on shifting the costs and burdens in patent infringement cases. Could I get each of your thoughts on how effective, you know, we can expect that to be at curbing abusive legislation? Will it have any significant impact, or does the solution lie somewhere else? Scott?
Well, I think you ought to be careful in looking at this and more careful about how it might be implemented because fee shifting, of course, is available right now. It's 35 U.S.C. 285 provides for, in exceptional cases, the court to award attorney's fees to the prevailing party. And it's used in the court's discretion when it does see an exceptional case, which is usually a case of some spurious litigation or some untenable positions taken in litigation. But just having a straight-up loser pays could have some unintended consequences that concern me because you could have a situation where, for example, you have a small company just trying to get off the ground. They've got some great technology. They have some patents. And then they find that a large competitor has moved into their space and has all the advantages of a large established competitor. The thing that small company has is its patents to defend its intellectual property from its unauthorized use by its large competitor. And so today, the small company files a patent infringement suit, but if it's a loser pays, the small company has to think about the consequences of losing, even if they're meritorious. They could have a fantastic case. And, you know, sometimes juries do things that you don't expect. Sometimes judges do some things you don't expect. There's a lot of uncertainty in patent litigation. So, this is one of these situations where something that I think is being promoted to help small companies in defending suits could actually discourage small companies from protecting their intellectual property when they're plaintiffs. So my concern is that we need to be cautious, we need to think about it, and try to come up with something that I think still provides for judicial discretion to see when they see a situation where fee shifting is merited. The courts can do that.
Adam, do you have any additional thoughts on that?
Yeah, so certainly one-way fee shifting is unjust and should be suspect. I think that's why you see the pushes towards adopting more two-way fee shifting, such as in Chairman Goodlatte's proposed draft and what I've heard will be subsequent iterations of other drafts or other bills such as the Shield Act and whatnot. but even with um, but even even with two-way phase shifting, one has to ask, is this something that is actually necessary, especially for keying two-way phase shifting to attributes of the litigant as opposed to the litigation behavior and the actual nature of the litigation. In fact, Judge Michel made this, Judge Michel, you may know, former chief judge of the Federal Circuit, recently made a very excellent point in a National Press Club a couple of weeks ago about how, you know, the focus of patent litigation reform, if there is any, should focus on actions and not characteristics of the patent holders or the patent owners. So you shouldn't key fee shifting to the nature of the patent owner, whether they're a patent licensing entity, such as, I don't know how many of you know that IBM is actually a patent licensing entity, that or whether they or whether they key it to some other type of feature, whether it's the original owner or not, you know, that it should be focused upon the nature of the litigation behavior, the nature of the lawsuit and the behavior in the litigation. And with that respect, actually, the courts actually have existing procedural tools to deal with these types of bad behaviors as well. I don't deny that there are situations in which there are bad actors. That's true in every system. That's why we have the perpetual debates over tort reform in this country. That's why we have perpetual debates over medical malpractice reform. So we have perpetual debates about reforming contract lawsuits and complex commercial litigation because there's bad actors in every area of the law. The question is whether you actually have a systemic breakdown of the system such that you require a systemic type fix. And we have to be very careful about asking very specific questions when systemic fixes are proposed. And one of those questions I think that we need to ask is this actually the tools being offered in the so-called systemic fix something that doesn't already exist? And right now, judges actually have the ability to shift fees, and they have the ability to punish bad actors in the patent system. And in fact, some of you may not know that the most active appeals court circuit for imposing sanctions on litigants for abusive litigation practices is the Federal Circuit. There are more Rule 11 cases, which is the rule in the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure for sanctioning attorneys and parties for misbehavior in lawsuits. There are more Rule 11 cases in the Federal Circuit than in any other circuit in the country right now. And so I think that we need to be careful here. I think Scott makes an excellent point about unintended consequences, proposed systemic changes to the system, and that we need to focus on actual actions and actual behaviors and actual statistics.
Matt, you have some thoughts?
Yes. So I think there's a number of very valuable proposals that have been discussed recently. Bills have been put forward that explore the issue of fee shifting, and I should note that while we do have Rule 11 sanctions, those are I think rarely enforced in U.S. law. What we're talking about here is fee shifting for parties taking unreasonable or unjustified positions, which is not the same egregious conduct standard that we apply in Rule 11. And when folks say, well, the sky's going to fall if we do fee shifting, I should point out that we do fee shifting in copyright, which is another species of intellectual property, and that hasn't been the source of the sky falling. So some valuable proposals, Patent Abuse Reduction Act, which I think Eric mentioned, Senator Cornyn's proposal has a fee shifting. Obviously, the SHIELD Act has some fee shifting proposals. One valuable idea in the Patent Abuse Reduction Act is also bringing interested parties into play. There's an increasing trend of using what people have called privateers, which is essentially a kind of litigation by proxy exercise where a third party is brought in to litigate against someone whom a company might not want to litigate against, right? And so it's sort of litigation, I know some have called it litigation laundering. And if you are an interested party who uses a third party to initiate litigation, in some cases it's been suggested that fee shifting could occur against the employer of the sort of mercenary actor. Another fee shifting related proposal, which I think is worth keeping in mind, is the proposal to have a bond for civil discovery, because in some cases you could have a fee-shifting order, but it would be against an entity who because their only product is litigation, doesn't have a whole lot of resources in the first place other than, say, bringing lawsuits on contingency. And so that would be sort of related, helpful proposal to consider.
Tim, your thoughts?
Yeah, thanks for the question. I think we need to step back for just a moment. Fee shifting can be tremendously helpful as one of a series of efforts to try to cure a bigger problem. And the bigger problem, I think, is that we have an entire business model predicated on investment in litigation. There are businesses and hedge funds which are literally being built to go out and extract money from other corporations using patents which may be overbroad, vague, underwhelming, or maybe overwhelming, but should never have been granted. And so anything that we can do, anything that Congress can do to change the incentive from a business standpoint for the investment in those types of businesses that their sole purpose is to extract money from companies that are making things is a really good thing. And so fee shifting falls into that category of one effort that can be done or could be achieved in multiple different ways to sort of bend the cost curve, to reduce the rate of return on these hedge funds' investment in litigation. And so whatever we can do here in the halls of Congress to encourage a series of measures which makes it less profitable for people to invest in trolling behavior as opposed to building the next wind farm or the next energy development company or the next great technology company is a really good thing, because as investment dollars will shift, I think we will see a commensurate benefit to consumers. The fee-shifting provisions that have been suggested work, especially when there's a bond involved for the company that is filing these lawsuits against tens, if not thousands, of companies for alleged infringement, because it causes the trolling entity to put money into a bonded situation, and so that they actually have a litigation disincentive, right? It makes them have to put forth their capital, and it reduces this opportunity for there to be costless litigation filed by the plaintiffs. And I think that's the real benefit, right? It forces those companies to think about whether or not sending out yet another demand letter to yet another company and then filing a claim is in fact a worthwhile endeavor, or whether or not they should either reduce the number of targets or stop altogether in terms of alleging the infringement. But the bigger problem here is really that we've got an investment model that creates a set of businesses whose only business is to extract settlements out of companies that are actually making things.
Thanks, Tim. Other proposed legislation addresses what's called patent quality. And patent quality is interesting. How can we measure that, whether it's in the high-tech industry or for any other firms working in the innovation industry? The Patent Quality Improvement Act of 2013, introduced by Senator Schumer, makes permanent a post-grant review program to review the validity of covered business method patents. It also expands the covered language beyond financial products or services. I want to get each of your thoughts on, if this is another possible solution, is this another avenue that's worth exploring? Scott.
I think everybody would support the PTO's efforts to continuously improve the patents that are issued by that agency. They do a great job now, and anything that can improve patent quality in terms of the patents that come out originally are issued by the Patent and Trademark Office, that's a great thing. Let me suggest, though, another measurement, if you will. You ask, how do you measure patent quality? And maybe it would help if I described a little bit about what licensing is all about, what we do, what other companies, any company that licenses patents. We contact a company that thinks we believe is using our intellectual property, and we set up a meeting. We send them claim charts. We explain why. We go to meetings with them. We explain why we believe they're using our intellectual property, why they're infringing our patents, and they respond. And we have a series of meetings. We call them technical meetings. That's the industry term. They're technical meetings because you're talking about the technical merits of the patents, back and forth. Do you infringe? Is it valid? That is where pre-litigation patents are really tested, and that's where you get a real sense of what the quality is. before you even get to litigation. And so that's one of the big benefits of licensing in this country. And we sometimes, and I know all companies do this, sometimes you take a patent into licensing and it turns out that there's issues with the patents, and you will go in and you will have it, the patent reexamined or reissued on your own merit because you realize that this patent has something in, about it, the way it was issued, it needs to be improved. So I think that is probably the primary way that we can, the patent quality, frankly, is measured, because then we do, I talked about us as a patent licensing company, but we do file patent infringement suits, because if you think about it, a patent license is a contract negotiation, and sometimes when you have contract negotiations, they break down and somebody files suits. So we do that. But when we do that, because we've already been negotiating with the other company and sometimes other companies for years discussing the merits of these patents, we go into the litigation knowing exactly what the issues are with this patent, what our positions are, what their positions are, and what the issues with the patent are. And so you have a situation where everybody goes into the litigation with their eyes open and they're able to evaluate their positions with respect to that patent quite accurately.
Adam, you have some thoughts on that as well?
Yes. I like Tim's point about let's step back and take context of the big picture, because very oftentimes when you're caught up in the moment of what seems to be a crisis, where you have clients who are being sued, you tend to think that this is the biggest thing in the entire world, and I can understand that, and it's perfectly understandable. This tends to be an issue in the patent system generally, that at any particular point in time where people have been involved in litigation, the rhetoric about the patent system at that point in time has been very strong about the patent system being broken. And I'm speaking from some expertise about this because I actually have studied the history of the U.S. patent system. That's my area of expertise. I read every patent decision from the 19th century. It's every recorded patent decision. It's about 1,400 of them in the Federal Case Reporters. I read legislative history to all the patent acts up through about 1952. I haven't yet dug into the American Vents Act yet, and related commentary. And I can tell you that it is a constant theme in the American patent system from the early 19th century up to today that the patent office is issuing bad patents, that there's bad litigation occurring as a result of these bad patents, that there's patent licensing entities who are engaging in bad litigation tactics and are holding up manufacturers. And because patent licensing has long been a business model of the American patent system from the get-go. Well, many people don't realize that Charles Goodyear never manufactured any rubber. The Goodyear company has nothing to do with Charles Goodyear. He solely licensed his patents and sued on infringement. And his name just became associated with rubber, and so when the Goodyear tire company was formed 50 years after he died, they named it after him because they wanted to be associated with the man who invented vulcanized rubber in 1839. Elias Howe, the inventor of the lock stitch, never manufactured a sewing machine. He solely licensed. In fact, Isaac Singer threatened to kill him by throwing him down the stairs when he asked for a royalty payment for the use of his patented invention. and many others. In fact, Thomas Edison was a patent licensing entity, not just a patent licensing entity, but someone who got funders and investors who not only invested in Menlo Park, but also invested in his litigation and supported him in the many lawsuits that his patents were involved in, and just as with Elias Howe. In fact, Elias Howe in 1850 had to get a third party to fund his lawsuits as well at that time. So there's a lot of assertions about, oh, well, this business litigation model and third-party financing of litigation and things of that sort is this new phenomenon. But from the big picture, it's actually not. And then the question is it occurring today at a greater level than it has in previous years? Is patent quality worse now than it has been in previous years? And those are empirically unanswered questions as of this point in time. There are some statistics that are thrown around, like the $29 billion in 2011. That study has been heavily criticized by Jay Kasson at the University of Illinois and David Schwartz of Chicago Kent, who identified serious and fundamental substantive and methodological flaws of that study, from relying upon secret data that they will not disclose to anyone, to serious methodological problems with how they defined a non-practicing entity and things of that sort. And in fact, it hasn't been published in a peer-reviewed economics journal. It won't be. It was published in a law journal that's published by students. For those who don't know, students run law journals. So the question here is on patent quality and the litigation that arises from patent quality. You have a lot of complex questions here, and from the big picture perspective, I understand that there are some issues and concerns with some bad actors in the system, but the question is, as empirically, at a systemic level, is patent quality a more serious problem, and do we have more serious litigation today as a result of lower patent quality? And from a big picture perspective, I have not been convinced yet by the evidence, and I have been trying to immerse myself in it empirically, both historically and the recent economic studies as well.
So, we were talking about patent quality. So, I think there are a number of proposals on the table. Eric mentioned Senator Schumer's Patent Quality Improvement Act, and a discussion draft that's been circulated by the House Judiciary that would expand this covered business method program is a very good idea. And I think I agree with Adam's contention that we've talked throughout our history about patent quality, and there is a constant narrative that patents, that there's a lot of friction in the patent system. And that admits two possibilities. One is that there's a sort of global, never-ending conspiracy to undermine the patent system by litigants. The other one is that we're actually always bad at administering the patent system, that there is a lot of friction around it, and that it is a system that requires constant improvement. And I actually think the latter is probably a more reasonable result, that we are humans, we are fallible, we ask patent examiners to assign rights in the intangible based on a few hours of work, and that admits a high error rate. And we have a system that's designed to correct it for those errors occur nevertheless, and so we have to continually aspire to improve patent quality. One of the famous letters that any of our founders ever wrote about intellectual property was a letter by Thomas Jefferson to a farmer named Isaac McPherson, who was being sued on a patent. He was being invited to take a license. And he wrote to Jefferson, and in Jefferson's letter, he basically says, yeah, well, maybe this, I'm summarizing, he's far more eloquent, but maybe this patent wasn't valid, but Jefferson himself had actually signed off on the patent. So we've been getting this wrong, actually that was exactly 200 years ago, we've been getting this wrong for centuries, and we can always do better, and certainly the fact that we aren't perfect, it shouldn't condemn the entire patent system, but it also shouldn't prevent us from trying to make constant improvement.
The short answer to your question is yes. Congress should, in fact, hastily passed the Schumer provision, which would extend this opportunity for hasty reexamination of patents and to examine their underlying quality. And it should extend it to other industries beyond the financial industry, which is where it was first provided in the passage of the American Invents Act. We think, I think Matt has spoken to this, that patent quality questions aren't new, but let's be wise about it. We have an overwhelmed patent and trademark office based on a number of patents that they are asked to look at and the number of hours that we can possibly look at them. So let's have this curative opportunity built into the system so that we can, go ahead and quickly re-examine whether a patent is good, bad, or somewhere in between.
Mm-hmm. One more question to go around, and we'll be sure we have time for questions at the end. I just want to explore the economics of this a little bit more and how much litigation is really costing American technology companies and our economy, and whether the costs are borne differently by different industries. If you could each just comment on that briefly, and then we'll get right into questions. Scott?
Well, I would say that, having been involved in patent litigation since 1991, everybody, plaintiffs and defendants, have always complained about the cost of litigation, right? Everybody would prefer to not spend money on patent litigation. They would prefer to spend it otherwise. That's the cost of having a patent system in which you have the opportunity to enforce your patents. And so this is not a new issue, and the costs are there. What I think would be a useful approach would be to go back and look at some of the ways in which judges have the tools to control the cost of litigation in each particular case. There are proposals out there. Back when I started practicing law, the Eastern District of Texas, which is where I practice a lot, had a disclosure process that was a precursor to the Rule 26 initial disclosure that eventually got codified in the federal rules and worked really well. They kept a tight rein on discovery, but it was done on a case-by-case basis. And again, you've heard me say this before, I think that any measure should be considered to be applied by the judges on a case-by-case basis in their discretion, because those judges are the people who best know how to handle the matter, and they know how to handle the matter, and they do.
Adam, you have some brief thoughts as well?
So I've already mentioned the $29 billion number as problematic. I think, as Scott touches on a valid point, which is that, you know, people complain about the cost of litigation throughout the entire U.S. civil litigation system. It's not just a complaint in the patent system. If you go and talk to people who work in, you know, on Wall Street, or people who run shoe businesses on Main Street, they'll tell you, you know, we don't like paying our lawyers, and the trial system is very expensive to navigate in the United States, both at the state and federal level. And that is largely because in the 1960s we shifted to a very discovery-heavy, discovery-dependent litigation system. And the result of that is litigation is expensive across the board, and it's even more expensive when you're dealing with complex technical issues, whether it's in patents or whether it's a complex technical issue in environmental law or other type or a complex technical issue in health and safety law or anything of that sort. Then the question becomes, well, is the patent system where there are particular patent actors that are experiencing more litigation? And there have been some recent statistical claims such as the recent claim that, for instance, 62% or over 50% of patent lawsuits filed today are now by patent licensing companies, and they're filed against small companies. That's actually a misstatement of the study that was done by Colleen Chen. Colleen Chen's study does not actually use the variable small companies. The variable that she uses is what she calls unique defendants. It's a somewhat complicated variable in the study. Essentially what she did is she counted the number of defendants in a lawsuit, not the number of lawsuits. So, for instance, if you have a patent licensing company like Mossade, and let's say that they file 100 lawsuits against large company A, let's say IBM, and then one lawsuit against small company B for the infringement of the same patent, then according to Colleen's study, you have two unique defendants with a 50-50 split between 101 lawsuits. And so that is the basis by which she is concluding that small companies make up the majority of the number of lawsuits being filed in this country, and that patent licensing companies are, in fact, making up a majority of the number of lawsuits that are being filed as well. So I think that there should be more empirical studies of these issues. I think that we do need more data, but we need good data and solid data that's being properly and accurately reported in the media and in our public policy debates.
By the way, if I can just interject, we have not filed anywhere close to 100 patent lawsuits against anybody. We've maybe filed 15 in the history of the company. We haven't filed any this year. So I
apologize, Scott. I was doing a classic professor hypothetical. It was just a hypothetical.
Matt, you have some thoughts as well.
Yeah, so there are some criticisms of the $29 billion figure, but I don't want to go into sort of, increasing specificity. Instead, I'll say that figure is probably not the only will be under inclusive for what the actual costs of the system are. So if you poll engineers about whether the patent system works, the guys who are not only the inventors that are listed on these patents, 80% of them will 80% of software engineers will tell you that they don't think the system's working. And that's in part because they see themselves and their peers writing interrogatory responses instead of software code. Right? They're spending time responding to the costs of litigation instead of doing their job, of doing R&D, of
of creating that stuff that the Bureau of Economic Analysis thinks is so important that we're rewriting our GDP figures to account for it. Right? So we've come to a point where producing a product has become a liability. And if litigation is your product, you are sort of incentivized much better off because you have a lot less exposure. And so those are additional costs that we need to take into account and try and mitigate.
Tim, you have some final thoughts?
Yeah. Let's imagine that the order of magnitude of costs in litigation is off by a full order of magnitude. Let's imagine it's just $2.9 billion, and only in Washington is $2.9 billion, just to adjust $2.9 billion. But let's imagine that's the number. It's an enormous problem, right? It is a cancer on industry. It is a cancer on development. No matter what the size of the figure is, it's an erroneous diversion of resources, of intellectual effort, of productive use of people's time, and it certainly is a problem that deserves to be solved. Moreover, when you talk to our developers, who are, as I said, the front line of this wave of efforts on trolling behavior, they tend to not even get to the stage of litigation because they have a bet-the-company moment. They get a demand letter, and they have to choose then and there whether or not they are going to license technology, which they believe they are not infringing in the main, and pay an enormous amount of money to do it, or pay much greater sums to fight their battle and vindicate their battle over the next several years, diverting their time, their resources, the experts' time, the engineers' time, which is so critically important. Let me give you a perfect example. In our conversations with developers around the country, we ran into an individual. His testimonial is up on our website. It's devs, D-E-V-S, build.it, or devs build it. And on that website, his testimonial talks about having 5 employees and 6 lawyers. And that's his experience as an entrepreneur, right? That he literally has to double his capacity of employees with the number of lawyers in order to keep up with the patent litigation, which he contends is completely erroneous and that his companies don't infringe. And I think that's a really good emblematic example of what's going on the front lines of America's intervention. So here's the last difficult challenge for everybody. It used to be that this was only our industry, right? It was only the tech industry that had this keen problem where entrepreneurs were getting hit up front with these sort of licensing technology problems before we got to even the litigation problem, and there's a bigger patent litigation problem. But now, let's face it, folks, software is everywhere. There is not an industry out there that does not rely on software, which means they rely on the developers that we represent. Whether you're a grocer or a retailer or a trucking industry, everything you do is being driven by lightweight applications, right? So what happens to our industry is happening and will affect all of these industries. And I think that's what's causing, Eric, much of the tumult here in Congress, is that entities like grocers are now getting sued, and JCPenney's getting sued for using software, and retailers are getting sued for using software. And so that, to me, suggests we have a real problem, and it's time for Congress to act.
I want to thank all of our panelists. I'd like to open the floor for questions. Just please identify yourself. Yes, sir. To any of our panelists?
Well, I think that's an interesting provision in Goodlatte's, Chairman Goodlatte's current bill to direct the Judicial Conference to look at some of these issues, because I think the courts are the people that know how to deal with these issues most directly, and they're the ones who are able to implement rules and policies and procedures that can address these issues on a case-by-case basis, because the vast majority of patent litigation is just like it's always been, and we need to deal with the outliers, with the spurious cases, yes, but an all-encompassing solution, I think, has the potential, as I started out by saying, to cause some unintended consequences and unjust consequences. For example, the patent pilot program, where we've got certain courts that are now having particular judges take a larger number of cases, so they become much more familiar with patent issues, with patent discovery, with how to handle cases. And those are also a lot of the courts that are implementing some of the really interesting civil case management issues right now. Northern District of Illinois, for example, has a new one that's I'd love to see how that works out over the next couple of years and how that affects the way they manage cases and handle cases. So I think the judiciary definitely has a role to play, and I think the judiciary needs to step up, and we need to give the time for these kinds of things to work their way through the system.
Does anyone else have anything else to add to that, Matt?
That's a great question. And I think the short answer is yes, there are some things the judiciary can fix. So not long after that debate started years ago, Tony, you might remember the Supreme Court came out and struck down a sort of patent-specific rule that the Federal Circuit had made. This was in eBay versus Merck Exchange, where the court had basically said, well, for all of U.S. law, we do injunctions this way, but for patents, we're going to make them easier. And the Supreme Court said, well, that doesn't make much sense. And, in fact, we actually have that rule right now, which some of the legislation proposes to respond to. Under Twombly, which was a Supreme Court decision from a few years ago, we have a sort of pleading standard that requires a certain degree of specificity, and the Federal Circuit has said, well, for patents, we're going to do it differently, which creates this situation where you don't actually have to identify the claims that are being infringed when you sue somebody on patent, which would be a little bit like suing somebody for trespass, but then not telling them where the property is located that they're trespassing on, and I think people would realize that's kind of ridiculous. So things like that might, in theory, be addressed by the court. I would note that those cases started being taken by the Supreme Court only after there was obvious manifest interest in patent reform on the Hill. And then, additionally, there's a lot of things that the court can't take into account. The court cannot resolve the sort of pre-litigation problems that the small app developers that Tim represents are having. There's simply no way to control the costs that are imposed in the shadow of the law in conference rooms, where you go in and someone says, okay, well, I don't think I infringed this patent. And they say, well, if you don't take a license on this patent, I have 100 more in my portfolio, and I'll just come back with those, right? So those aren't really things that the court can handle, and nor can the court really effectively police quality. And, you know, for reasons I think we discussed, there are quality initiatives that need to be undertaken. So
that's actually an excellent point about quality because, you know, it's interesting that everyone's complaining about quality, and yet the American Events Act of 2011 established an extensive administrative review procedures at the Patent and Trademark Office to address this exact problem, and why aren't we waiting for that to take into effect, to go into effect fully and to see what the impact of that will be? We now have up to 6 different ways in which third parties and defendants in lawsuits can challenge the validity of a patent at the Patent Office, where there can be both re-examination of the patent in an adversarial-type proceeding as well as on an individual basis. And, you know, the ink isn't even dry on the American Events Act yet. There hasn't even been full implementation of these procedures, and yet we're now talking about adopting more changes to the patent system, more changes to how patents are enforced and are reviewed by courts and other government bodies. And my position would be, well, let's wait for the American Events Act to be implemented. Let's see some of the impact from the something like 8 to 10 cases that the U.S. Supreme Court has taken in the patent law in the past 5 or 6 years. The U.S. Supreme Court has heard more patent cases in the past 5 or 6 years than it has since the mid-19th century. And so there's been a lot of tumult already in the doctrine and changes to the rules. And before we start making more changes, which will create more uncertainties about how these are being implemented or not, layering new changes upon new changes before they even have been fully implemented yet, let's take a breather and let's see how these changes are implemented. A lot of people, if you recall, we were doing these briefings in 2011, where a lot of people were saying that the post-issuance review procedures at the Patent Office will be the solution to the problem of patent quality. And now we're saying patent quality is a disaster and everything of that sort. Well, let's we're a year and a half since those review procedures have begun to be implemented. Let's give them some time to work and see how it works. We are human, and we have human institutions, so let's give them time to work.
Additional questions, anyone? Front row.
Charles, thanks for the question. So I think the experience is going to differ. I represent a whole group of small startup companies in my personal capacity, and I see just from that anecdotal experience divergent perspectives. Some people have felt they needed to go and get a patent as one of the very first things they do to spend money on because they felt that they needed to establish the territory to give themselves the breathing room, literally the elbow space, to go ahead and build a business and bring that product to market. And others have said, let's just rush to market, and later on, if we need to, we will get patents. I think the more enlightened view is that a series of app developers are getting together, and they are beginning to pool patents. They're getting to say, we will have reciprocal licenses where we offer these opportunities to each other without a license fee, because we understand that software is a building block kind of industry, where literally you build block by block by block, and every block before is considered in some ways communal. It's considered foundational to the practice of building software. So I think that's the direction we're heading, but it's out of response to these series of demand letters that people are receiving that companies that I have seen are going and rushing and spending tens of thousands of dollars drafting up patents with many claims and trying to get them filed as soon as possible. To protect themselves in almost a defensive posture.
The essence of the patent system is a property right in a new and useful technology. And a lot of people think of the patent system as promoting new inventions. And that's certainly one purpose of having property rights in new inventions, is that if you say you get a property right in something you create, then that will incentivize people to want to do it. But by identifying it and protecting it under the laws of property right, which was, by the way, a unique American approach to securing patents, not originally followed by in England and otherwhere, where they thought of them as exclusive personal privilege grants, but not in the United States. They said, no, these are property rights. There's a second function to that, which is what sometimes scholars refer to as a commercialization function, which is that property is not the securing of property isn't just about incentivizing the creation of a new type of asset or resource, but also figuring out the best ways to utilize it and deploy it in the marketplace, to get it into the hands of consumers. And so what a property right secures to someone is the freedom to make the decisions as to how to best structure deals, whether to enter into patent pools, which were a creation of American patent owners in the 1850s, in innovative creation of the very first patent war, the sewing machine war of the 1850s, as well as other types of deals, including, by the way, the ability to say, I'm going to choose to exercise my property right by letting other people access it for free. There's a lot of talk, for instance, about how the Internet is open and how we allegedly don't have property rights in the Internet in a fundamental way. A lot of people don't realize that the packet switching technology, which is the essence of the technological transfer of information on the Internet, as well as what's called the TCP/IP protocol, which is the core protocol of the entire communications on the Internet, both of those technologies were patented. And they were patented, and yet we had the development of the Internet and the development of an open framework, because that was their choice as to how to deploy their property rights. So what a property right gives you the right to do is to say how you want to deploy it, and it gives business persons the ability to innovate new ways to develop it. If I had said to you 15 years ago that Apple would have stores in malls selling their products, you would have said, are you nuts? Apple just makes computers, and they sell them through resellers. They don't run their own stores. They're not a retailer. They're not JCPenney. And yet Apple has stores because they've engaged in commercial innovation in a way to deploy their technology, which, by the way, this has been secured to them as property rights through their patents.
Any other questions from our audience today? Well, I want to thank all of our panelists, and I appreciate all of you coming today. We look forward to having you at our next event on June 7th. Thanks again.
Thank you for coming. I did it indirectly.